Is it moral to believe that your sins can be forgiven by the punishment of another person? I would submit that the doctrine of vicarious redemption by human sacrifice is utterly immoral, a positively immoral doctrine that abolishes the concept of personal responsibility on which all ethics and all morality must depend.
The voice of Christopher Hitchens, he's one of the more famous new atheists out there. We're going to be responding to the arguments of the new and the old atheists here for the remainder of this hour of Issues Etc. Dinesh D'Souza will join us here in just a moment. You can join us with questions or comments. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, September the 3rd, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE. You can also email your questions or your comments to us right here in the studio. We'll get your questions and comments via email in real time. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Talkback at issuesetc.org. The books are out there. Letter to a Christian Nation, the name Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and so many others. They write books. They sell books. They are unabashedly, unapologetically atheist. Some of them, like Richard Dawkins, claim to have science on their side. What's different about the new atheists? They're aggressive. They tend to ridicule Christianity a little more freely than atheists in the past. Their books are, if you read them, not so much treatises against theism in general, but treatises against Christianity in particular. Christopher Hitchens says he just cannot understand why something as immoral as human sacrifice, Jesus hanging dead on the cross, could be at the very heart of a religion that claims to be moral. He says it undermines every moral claim and every moral fiber Christianity claims to have. How do you respond to this? How do you respond when someone says, look, we're the atheists and we have science on our side? Or when someone says, we're the atheists, you're the church, and don't you know what the church did to poor Copernicus when he came up with more rational ideas, more observable ideas about what the universe is and how it's put together? What is the essence of the atheists' polemic when they argue against Christianity? Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I don't know if I believe in atheists. Atheists don't believe in God. I don't know if I believe in atheists. I know that there are people who consider themselves atheists, who try their hardest on a day-by-day basis to be atheists, that is, to deny the existence of God, to put God out of their minds, although they seem to write an awful lot about God for those who are trying to live in a world without him. Now, they would say, well, the problem is all these religions around us, and we have to answer this somehow, this irrational, based on faith and not on fact thing that we call religion, and Christianity is particularly egregious in this respect. But when I say I don't believe in atheists, what I mean to say is I don't know if anyone can consistently live and function psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, in open denial of God. It's very difficult to pull off. I'm sure it's very tiring. Dinesh D'Souza is our guest. He's former White House domestic policy analyst, research scholar for the Hoover Institute, author of the book, What's So Great About Christianity? He's going to be debating Christopher Hitchens, famous atheist, September 10th at Powell Symphony Hall in St. Louis. Dinesh, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, good to be on the show.
Why are the new atheists, as they're calling themselves and being called by the media, why are they so vocal today?
Well, I think part of it is that they have taken advantage of 9/11 and of the rise of what you could call Islamic radicalism or Islamic terrorism. Essentially, what the new atheists have said is, hey, look, you've got these crazy people over there who are blowing up buildings and killing people in the name of God. Well, if you really look at it, the Christians are not so different. These Abrahamic religions came out of the same fanatical soil. They all read holy books, and it leads them to do irrational things, but not just irrational or unscientific things, but today, dangerous things. And so the new atheists have taken the argument beyond the idea that religion is in some ways irrational, blind, blind faith, as they call it, and they say it's now positively toxic, positively dangerous. The world would be much more peaceful and rational if you didn't have religion in it. So they've generalized from Islamic radicalism to sort of say a pox on everybody's religious house.
What is the vocal atheist's goal? It's certainly not live and let live anymore. What is the goal?
Not anymore, and that's important to recognize because there are actually a lot of Christians who are sort of sleepy Christians who sort of thought, well, you know what, we've got a treaty in a way here in the secular culture. The treaty is this. We let the public square stay neutral. In fact, we even give it up to the secularists. But we retreat into the private sphere, the home, the church, the family. We practice our religion, you might say, in private. And the new atheists have sort of rejected this treaty, and they say, wait a minute. No. If religion is bad, not only should it be abolished from the public square, but really, why should parents be allowed to inculcate religious beliefs in young people? That would be like teaching young people to do crazy and dangerous things. So the atheists say, well, we realize that in a free society, we can't do anything about that in terms of parental upbringing. But you know what? When you send your kids off to school and college, that's when we'll be waiting for them. And if you program Christianity into your children, it's going to be our job to deprogram it. So the idea here is atheism, you may say evangelical atheism or missionary atheism, an atheism that wants to proselytize, that wants to get the religion out of the minds of young people.
You have debated Christopher Hitchens, famous new atheist, before. What was the very best point he made in the debate, Dinesh?
Well, Hitchens is often regarded as perhaps the best of the debaters on the atheist side. He's an Oxford guy. He's very literate. He's witty. He's an attractive individual. He's a jovial guy. You have the feeling he's the kind of guy you'd like to have dinner with. And all of this makes him a formidable opponent. He's also not a mechanical debater who makes fixed points that you can say, oh, he said that last time, so I'll get him this time, because he's resourceful. He adapts. And if here is an argument that he couldn't answer. We debated in New York last October. So if I made a point that he couldn't answer, he'll have thought about it in the meantime and come back with all kinds of stuff. So the bottom line is he's got a battery of shifting arguments, but they're very clever. To give you a sort of a typical example, he'll say, well, look, what kind of crazy God do you Christians believe in? You know, he says, man has been on this planet for a long time. Let's say 50,000 years, maybe 100,000 years. So he'll say, according to you, Dinesh, your God, for about 95,000 of those years, did absolutely nothing. Even though conditions on the earth were horrendous, infant mortality, bloody wars, tribal rampages, rotting teeth, people dropping dead at the age of 30, your God was in the tent drinking margaritas, having fun. Then about 3000 BC, God sort of decides, well, you know what, time for me to get involved. And he picks this, no, he doesn't pick China or India or not even Mesopotamia. He goes into the middle of nowhere and he picks this tribe of good-for-nothings, the Jews, and he picks one guy, Abraham, and starts whispering into his ear. And then Hitchens will say, well, and the news about that didn't even get to China for another 1,000 years. So the bottom line of it is that he gives this portrait of an extremely arbitrary, whimsical God who, if he really created the universe and cares about all of us, you think he'd reveal himself to us from the very beginning. But he acts in what seems to be a pretty arbitrary fashion. So Hitchens will slam you with that and wait to see what you have to say in response.
Before we go to this break, with only a minute, how would you summarize the essence of the atheists' polemic against Christianity? You've mentioned, I think, the first part of it, but what else is there to their polemic?
Well, I think what the power of their polemic is that they stand squarely behind, you might say, the methodology of modern science. They say, look, in the dawn of primitive man, people came up with religious theories. And why? Because they were ignorant. So, for example, if you see a hurricane and you don't know what caused it, you go, oh, wow, well, that was the hurricane god. And what causes lightning? Well, that was the lightning god. But now, through science, we know that there's a better way of figuring out what these things do and what they mean. Lightning is caused by electrical discharges. You don't need a lightning god. So the idea here is that as scientific knowledge advances, religion retreats into what can be called the god of the gaps. The God of the gaps is just the stuff that science hasn't explained to date. And so you almost have a picture here of science confidently moving forward and religion ducking and weaving and trying to censor the scientists, but fortunately being defeated. It's really a morality tale of the sort of the white knights of science against the black robes of the priests.
When we come back from this break, I want to examine a few of the myths that are embedded in that, as Dinesh D'Souza says, morality tale being told by the atheists regarding the relationship of Christianity, the church, and science. And I wonder, the atheists certainly claim to hold the intellectual, the empirical high ground. But is that true? Join us with your questions or comments as we talk with Dinesh D'Souza, author of the book What's So Great About Christianity, former White House domestic policy analyst, research scholar for the Hoover Institute. He's going to be debating with Christopher Hitchens, an atheist, September 10th at Powell Symphony Hall in St. Louis. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE. Email us with your questions or comments on this Wednesday, September the 3rd. Talk back at issuesetc.org. By the way, we've got more information on this debate between Dinesh D'Souza and Christopher Hitchens under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. 1-877-623-MYIE is our call-in number and our email address, talkback at issuesetc.org. Well, when you stand toe-to-toe with the atheist, he will say, I have science on my side, I have reason on my side, I hold the intellectual high ground. Is that true? We'll answer that question right after this.
My biggest fear is that this is not the talk of the devil, because there can be no devil if there is no God. And if there were a God,
that's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion.
We're responding to the arguments of atheists. Dinesh D'Souza, author of the book What's So Great About Christianity, is our guest. 1-877-623-MYIE or talk back at issuesetc.org. Dinesh, before the break, you were talking about this morality tale that is often told by atheists, this narrative of history, including figures like the church and Copernicus and Galileo. And they seem to say that from the very inception, nascent science was already winning the day over against a hostile Christianity. Is this true?
Well, historically, it's completely false. And what I mean by that is that the atheist case is really, the whole case really hinges on about two examples. The so-called flat earth theory, the Christians believed in the flat earth until we, the brilliant scientists, showed that the earth is round. The Christians thought that the earth is the center of the universe until first Copernicus and then Galileo, later Newton, showed the opposite, and finally Darwin. That's the whole case right there. But against that, first of all, those examples themselves need to be looked at. But more broadly, you find that the very origins of modern science come out of Christianity. The churches are the ones that sponsor the observatories and the laboratories, the great scientists. I mean, if you were to make a list of the 50 greatest scientists of all time or of Western civilization, about 45 of them are Christians, and about 48 of them are theists, believers in God. And so you find that it is out of Christian assumptions, the idea of an orderly universe, the idea of a universe created by a rational God that obeys laws and operates in the form of regularities, the idea of a human mind that is created, you might say, in the rational image of God and is sort of able to apprehend the universe. I mean, all these are deep assumptions built into Western science. And these assumptions don't come out of nowhere. In fact, other cultures, at least some of them, don't share them. So one can talk about the Christian roots of modern science, and this is something the atheists seem historically completely ignorant about.
I was listening to a lecture being given in New York City recently by the author of a book called The Elegant Universe. He's a particle physicist or something like that. I thought the book was fascinating, but he's sitting there talking about we live in a godless universe. All that there is matter and energy and the forces that act between them. And he went on to say, well, the universe is so vast and so infinite that anything that can happen does happen. He was asked the question, well, what about some place in the universe where the people who think they're living in the universe are actually living in a very elaborate simulation of an advanced civilization? It's just a computer simulation. It's not the real universe. He said, well, you know, given what I've said about the vastness of the universe, that's not only likely, it's more likely than not. And I began to wonder to myself, this is a guy who would deny intelligent design, but he says that somewhere in the universe there are people who think they're living in a universe of evolution that's actually the product of design.
Right. Well, I know who you're talking about. It's the physicist Brian Greene.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what you may call quantum craziness. And what I mean by this is that when you probe matter and you go to the level of the very, 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 very small, matter behaves in strange ways. The normal rules appear to be thrown out the window, you might say. Now, the problem with this is that that's true, but that is true at that level of the operation of matter. The problem is that a lot of guys who come across this rather surprising reality about matter in miniature, you might say, draw all kinds of fantastical metaphysical conclusions from that, and they're not even aware that they have jumped completely out of science into the realm of philosophy. I mean, consider simply, first of all, the statement that matter and forces is all that there is. Now, that is not a scientific statement. In fact, there has never been a scientific demonstration of anything like that point. How could you possibly prove that matter and forces are all that there is? What kind of test have you done that shows that convinces you of that? There is no such test. So what I'm getting at is, here's a guy who's sort of, you might say, using the authority of science to make metaphysical or philosophical points, and the gullible guy who doesn't know goes, well, he's a physicist. He probably knows what he's talking about. He does about physics. The same thing is true with the atheists like Richard Dawkins and so on. One reason I'm unafraid to debate these guys is not because they aren't really smart. They are. But they are smart in a narrow field. And yet you find that rather confidently they wander out of that field to make claims in realms, history, politics, philosophy. You'll find Richard Dawkins discoursing on the Shiites and the Sunnis. I mean, here's a guy who's basically an expert on evolutionary biology, giving us lectures about the Shia and the Sunni. Well, on that subject, he's a virtual ignoramus. And so I find it's very easy to sort of deflate these balloons because you get people who should be confined to an area that they know something about trying to speak in areas where they don't.
The atheists like to list the crimes of Christianity or the crimes of religion. What are some of the worst atrocities in human history, and what were the worldviews of the leaders who spearheaded those atrocities?
Well, let's take take an interesting example, because sometimes this debate just gets a little overheated and so on. And but just take a simple example. Take Osama bin Laden, who would probably be, you might say, the worst living exemplar of somebody doing bad things in the name of religion. And ask yourself, well, how many people has bin Laden killed? 3,000, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000? All right. Now, let's compare that to, for example, an atheist regime of recent years. And let's not even go for the big guys. I'm going to ignore Mao in China. I'm not going to talk about Stalin in Russia. Just take somebody like Pol Pot. Most people wouldn't even think of him in this category. He's, you might say, a little league atheist. And yet, in Indochina, after the Vietnam War, in a very short space of time, maybe 3.5 years, Pol Pot and his regime kill about 2 million people. Now, they do it, by the way, they do it not just for the sake of power, because they could have established, they had power before they killed all those people. They did it because of an ideology. They wanted, you might say, to create a new man and a new utopia, liberated from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. They were utopians, and they were guided, you might say, by a sort of Marxist atheist utopia. So here you have crimes directly in the name of atheism inflicted upon religious people. You see the same thing in Russia. You've seen the same thing in Cuba with Fidel Castro. So my point is, if you really want to make this gruesome ledger, you discover that the body count of atheism, the pools of blood shed by modern atheism, dwarf anything that religion can produce. And in fact, all the religions in the world put together haven't killed as many as atheist regimes have killed in about 10 years in the last century.
One of the things you talk about in your book is, with its Christian roots, Christianity presents a worldview and in some sense, philosophy and governments that recognize the fallibility of man. Why is that so important?
It's important for two reasons. One is it is at the root of our what may be called our liberal idea. Now, I don't mean our liberal idea in the sense of a Michael Dukakis idea, but our classically liberal idea that we should not trust people with absolute power. If you look at the American system of government, it's got all these strange engines in it, checks and balances, separation of powers, a Supreme Court that can rule a law unconstitutional, but then a public referendum that can overturn that court ruling. So why is power so decentralized in our society in such a way it's almost impossible, almost by design, to get anything done? Well, the bottom line assumption is that human nature is warped. And if you take one guy, even a great guy, and you give him all the power, chances are he'll use it really badly. So you see, here's a way in which we might say a Christian assumption, you mind, the fallibility of human nature, what Immanuel Kant called the crooked timber of humanity. Kant said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And the idea here is that you've got to devise systems, capitalism or free markets, also based on the idea that you assume human selfishness. People say, well, capitalism is so selfish. Well, no, no. The selfishness is not in capitalism. It's in human nature. Capitalism is a system designed to steer that selfishness in such a way that it produces not harm, but you might say the material betterment of society. So you see, when people often debate, is America a Christian society, they're getting into, shallow arguments about, was Jefferson really a true believer? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying if you just look around you, the basic institutions and values that people take for granted, even the secular guy, even Christopher Hitchens, those would be inconceivable if it wasn't for Christianity.
Andy is listening in Kirkwood, Missouri. Andy, thank you for waiting and welcome.
Hi, Todd. Just looking on the internet yesterday, and Russia is currently moving in its school textbooks to rehabilitate Stalin. And one of the arguments that they're using is, yes, he killed many people, but he did it for rational reasons. And I thought that was a pretty good argument against atheism.
Andy, thank you very much.
Well, it should be remembered that atheism has always been, you might say, the party of reason. It started with the French Revolution, long before communism. The idea was that you guillotine people because you're acting reasonably to create a better society. There are going to be people who will try to block that society, and you have to get rid of those people. Now, Stalin, I wouldn't describe as a pure rationalist. He was driven by powerful, emotional, nationalistic, tribal forces. But even so, the atheism has always been central to communism, and the proof of it is that the persecution of the priests, the attempt to shut down the churches, this is not the characteristic of this communist regime or that one. Every communist regime has acted that way.
Dinesh D'Souza is our guest. We're responding to the arguments of atheists and to your questions and your comments. 1-877-623-MYIE. 10 more minutes after this break. You can also email us, talkback@issuesetc.org. By the way, you'll find information on his book, What's So Great About Christianity, under the on-demand section of our website, issuesetc.org.
It isn't hard. Just believe in me.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes with Dinesh D'Souza, author of the book What's So Great About Christianity, research scholar for the Hoover Institute, and a former White House domestic policy analyst. You were talking before the break, Dinesh, about how it is that in American society we take for granted that much of it has come from the influence, the long influence in Western civilization of Christianity. Let's talk about that influence in terms of our sense of morality, but also our sense of natural law and of our country being a nation of laws and not of men.
Yes, I think that if you look at take a simple example that I think will help to clarify all this, and that is we're a nation of laws, and yet if you read Plato's Republic, you discover something surprising. Plato says that the best form of justice is not law. He says it's discretion. And if you think about it, in a way, he's right. For example, if you have three children, you don't say, you know what, I'm going to make a law and make all of you follow the same law. Rather, you have rules that are sort of adapted to the needs and wants of each particular person. Everybody's different. And a parent knows that I can tailor my rules to the particular personality and what is best for Sally as opposed to Bill as opposed to Jane. So you don't have laws. You have discretion. Now, that's the best form of justice. But if you think about it, we don't do that. We could do it. Let's take something like speeding on the highway. You could say, why don't we just have the cops hide, and then if somebody is speeding and driving recklessly, pull them over and give them a ticket. You don't need a speed limit for the obvious reason that there are some people who can drive safely at 75. Other people drive recklessly at 40. So don't have a rule, which is obviously going to be a generalization. Let the cop just make up his own mind. But interestingly, we don't do that. Why? Because we don't trust the policeman with that kind of power. So the argument for laws, again, comes out of the Christian assumption of the fallibility of human nature. We would rather have a law and everybody follow it, even if I feel like, you know what, I can drive safely at 75, but I go, no, I'd rather not give the cop that kind of power. So if I'm going over the speed limit, I'll take a ticket, but let's have the same rules apply, you might say, mechanically to everybody. It's a very small example, but it sort of illustrates a point. In ancient Greece and Rome, the Romans did embody the idea of law, but the notion of the fallibility behind law, checks and balances and so on, that comes out of Christianity.
Do the atheists recognize, I mean, these are smart people for the most part, do the atheists that you have debated and dealt with recognize that they, when they enjoy the freedoms, the egalitarian mindset, the benefits of law and whatnot, do they realize they're borrowing on Christian capital?
The answer to that is, in general, no. That it's very rare for people to see that. And I think the reason for this is that Hitchens comes close to it. He's one of the smarter. But the thing is, a guy like Dawkins, for example, will simply say, well, you know what? I think we can get rid of the Christian God and keep Christian morality. In fact, at one point, Dawkins has even called himself a cultural Christian. He said, I have no problem with the Ten Commandments or the Christian rules of society and so on. He goes, I just don't think we need this big grandfather from the sky. We can get rid of him and keep everything else. Now, there's a whole bunch of other atheists, and I'm going to be debating in a few months Peter Singer from Princeton University, the philosopher. Now, he takes the opposite tack, and his argument is, you know what, if you get rid of the Christian God, you have to recognize that all the things that came out of Christianity are myths, because they're based on this idea of the mythical God. So take something as simple as the dignity of human life. Peter Singer's point is no God, no dignity of human life. I mean, go to the animal kingdom. Do you find animals respecting each other's dignity? Does the lion respect the dignity of the antelope? No. So why should we? What's the difference? We're primates like they are. So the idea here is that society should begin a major overhaul of all its ethics to purge Christianity out of Western civilization and create, you might say, a utilitarian or Darwinian form of ethics. So there are very few atheists who are willing, who have the guts and are willing to think things through at this level. The philosopher who did this first, I believe, is Nietzsche, the German philosopher about 150 years ago, 125 years ago, in his books Beyond Good and Evil and other books, where he basically said, you get rid of Christianity and all the rest of it has got to go too. You can't hang on to Christian morality, Christian values, Christian institutions. Once you remove the foundation, the building has got to come down.
But at least Nietzsche was consistent enough to say that if you bury God and finally carry out the funeral rite, then what you're left with is nihilism. Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. I mean, I don't know if there are many atheists who are willing, maybe except Peter Singer, willing to go that far.
Right. Now, Nietzsche's hope was that out of this nihilism, or out of this prospect of nihilism, you could build, man could build something even better. You know, Nietzsche's idea of the Superman and so on. But interestingly, the only people who have tried to approximate that vision were the Nazis. The idea of creating, you might say, a superior race. And ironically, if you look at Nazi recruiting slogans, they are a weird combination of Nietzsche and Darwin. So you take the phrases of Nietzsche, beyond good and evil, the idea of the Superman, the celebration of cruelty, and then you take the Darwinian idea, survival of the fittest, or, you know, only the best or the fittest will survive, the elimination of the unfit, and so on. And basically, you've got, in a miniature, the ingredients of Nazi propaganda. Now, again, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Nietzsche and Darwin would have been Nazis. I'm not saying they would have admired Hitler, but I'm saying the opposite, that Hitler and the Nazis admired them.
So what appeals about atheism?
The real appeal of atheism, in my view, see, a lot of Christians get foxed by this because on the surface it appears that the atheist is, you might say, an apostle of reason, a kind of would-be biologist or physicist who's merely following the data. But if you look a little bit more closely, you see that this is not true. Because after all, if you don't believe in something because there's not enough evidence, you basically just live your life as if that something did not exist. So, for example, I don't believe in unicorns. But you know what? I just live my life as if there were no unicorns. I don't go around writing books, you know, the end of unicorns, the unicorn delusion, unicorns are not great. I'm not obsessed by unicorns. But see, the atheists are obsessed by God. They spend a lot of their time holding atheist conferences, and they write books, and they've now created atheist Sunday schools and an atheist radio show and this kind of thing. So what they really want, they're almost building, you might say, on a negative philosophy. And I think the reason for it is it's not that they don't believe in God. What they kind of hate not just the Christian God, but I would argue mainly Christian morality. Hitchens, in one of his very revealing phrases, he talks about how morality, he says, I don't want to go to heaven because if I go to heaven, it's sort of like being in celestial North Korea. What's my job in heaven? Well, it's basically to stand in a line and hand out garlands. He goes, I don't want to be some kind of a peon handing out garlands. God is the great God. We all bow to him without ceasing. He goes, at least in North Korea, you die at some point and the tyranny comes to an end. Well, he says, in heaven, it never ends. So the point here is that God is seen as an enemy of human freedom. And I would argue the Ten Commandments are seen as an enemy of moral freedom. Thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that, and so on. So what's the atheist payoff? It's that if you don't believe in God, you don't have to follow any of his rules. Your life suddenly becomes something that you construct yourself. Morality becomes a tool that you use yourself. You make up the rules as you go along. It's a beautiful liberation from the laws that prohibit theft and adultery and all kinds of things that human beings want to do, but are, you might say, prohibited by this religion of cosmic justice and cosmic accountability from doing.
Dinesh D'Souza is former White House domestic policy analyst, research scholar for the Hoover Institute, author of the book What's So Great About Christianity. He'll be debating Christopher Hitchens, an atheist, September 10th at Powell Symphony Hall in St. Louis. If you go to our website tonight, issuezetc.org, click on demand. You'll find out more about next week's debate here in St. Louis. Dinesh, thanks for being our guest.
It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the program, we're going to discuss Moses. We're told in the epigraph to Moses' life, no greater prophet ever, save Christ, of course. Dr. David Adams will be our guest. You know, Christianity, if laid in the pantheon of world religions, can open itself to a lot of criticisms. A checkered past, certainly. The truth of Christianity is not found in its history or in its track record, although those things are not as bad as the atheists say. The truth of Christianity is not even found in its remarkable and, on the balance, good influence on Western civilization and society and law and all of the other things that Christianity has given birth to in our culture and society. The truth of Christianity rests, as St. Paul would remind us, upon one thing and one thing alone. Is Christ raised? Is Christ alive? Has Jesus, who laid down his life for us at the cross, shedding his blood as the sacrifice for our sins. Hitchens would call it terrible human sacrifice, immoral, God calls it a vicarious atonement, the greatest thing that ever occurred, mercy, forgiveness, life, and salvation in that death and that resurrection. Paul says, if Christ, who laid down his life at the cross for us, has not been raised, don't believe anything I say. Don't even consider it. Don't even talk about whether it's rational or logical or any of those things. If Christ is not raised, no further need for discussion. But Paul says, in fact, Christ has been raised. There is the truth of Christianity in a nutshell. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.